All right, everybody who came to see Gobbles, he didn't show up. He pulled a tangent, as we like to say. So instead we have Larry Lids, who's going to be giving a presentation on... Larry's going to give a presentation on stuff that keeps him up at night. But he's a very smart guy. He's going to give a good talk. Everybody give him a round of applause.
Hello? Is this on? Okay. So it was pointed out to me that I could have just stood up there and pretended to be Gobbles, and probably no one in this room has actually met him, so it probably would have worked out fine. But I'm not Gobbles, so I'm just going to talk about stuff that keeps me up at night and things that the security industry in general seems to have totally ignored. First, I'm going to talk about a few things that don't keep me up at night. Okay, I'll just hold this, and every once in a while I'll just gesticulate and go like this. But you know, yeah, if I'm doing this, you know, out here, remind me, and I'll try talking to it. So one of the things that seems to be a lots of FUD in the security industry, and of course what I'm talking about is FUD, because for those people walking in, Gobbles didn't show up. So if you expect me to be him, you know, you might as well leave. So I'm talking about all sorts of FUD, and there's a lot of FUD in the security industry. So I'm going to first talk about some of the FUD that's out there that... This work better? No. I'll just hold it. So I'm going to talk about a lot of the FUD that's out there that a lot of people seem to like spreading that I don't actually worry about, and things that don't bother me and don't scare me and so forth. And then I'll talk about the things that do scare me. So the first one is this cyberterrorism/electronic Pearl Harbor thing that everyone seems to want to talk about today, particularly government folks, probably because the government makes money or gets, you know, lots of funding. The people who do this, if you know, you want to talk about, you know, they're like, oh, we're going to defend the nation's infrastructures, and there's all this chance to have cyberterrorism. But I mean, how many people actually have heard of many cases where people have died because of cyberterrorism? Or because of, you know, security incidents in general. I haven't heard many of the cases. Every once in a while, you know, something will happen, and maybe, you know, someone might die. The person breaks into a machine, launches a denial of service attack, which takes out a network, and the failover thing, you know, doesn't work, and so forth. People are getting into machines that have access to power grids and dams and all of those stuff, airports. Alan Peller of SANS does a great presentation where he, you know, shows, you know, this airport in Maryland or Massachusetts somewhere where someone broke into the control tower and turned off the lights. But, I mean, for the most part, what ends up happening is that there's some sort of failover system that people actually know how to handle situations where failure occurs. Those people who read the Risk Digest are probably laughing at me right now and saying that's not true. But in general, I think it is true. So people rely on computers, but they don't rely on it exclusively. Something could happen with cyberterrorism where someone actually manages to find some way to do serious damage, and lots of people die and all that. But this isn't something that I think is too likely, so it doesn't worry me. The internet is broken. Every once in a while, someone's like, oh, this new attack is going to, you know, take down the entire internet. And again, this is something that, like, I mean, Slammer seems to be the most devastating worm to date so far in terms of the damage it did to the internet. And the internet was down, most of it, bits of it, for, you know, a good 6 hours. But that's not all that long of a period of time. I mean, the whole thing was designed to be fairly survivable, you know, the whole, like, survive nuclear blast sort of thing. So, bits and pieces might vanish, or the whole thing might go down for a short period of time. But for the most part, it seems to do a pretty good job of surviving. This one's one of those ones where I think, well, maybe in the future someone will find a good way to keep it down for a long period of time, but then my job's easier because I don't have a job and, you know, anyway. Liability suits for break-ins. This is another one that, like, you hear a lot of people now saying, ooh, the next new thing is people are going to be suing someone else saying, oh, you know, they broke into my machine and therefore I'm going to sue their company because they were negligent and so forth. Well, it seems to me negligence is really, really, really hard to prove. you end up getting like lots and lots of finger pointing. Like, okay, so I work at a university, and everyone says, oh, universities are bad. You know, no one knows how to do security at universities. And what happened is, so let's say my institution's the one, the University of Chicago. You can break into it if you want to, because it's not like it's hard. If you can't break into it, you're lame. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that if you were to, you know, break into the university and someone were to try to sue us over this break-in, because, you know, we were the man in the middle, and, you know, they'd get a whole bunch of experts sitting up on the stand saying, universities don't do security right because they don't do enough firewalling. And we'd get a whole bunch of experts on the stand saying, there are lots of other ways to do security other than firewalls. Firewalls are only part of a defense in depth. Therefore, you know, we're not negligent. And the fact of the matter is they're not going to have much success with liability unless they can prove negligence. On top of which, we would sit there and we would say, Microsoft, they're the problem. You know, they shouldn't have written this bad code in the first place. And then Microsoft's going to get up on the stand and say, well, you know, this is really hard and no one else can do it and so forth. So I don't think anyone's actually going to be able to make a compelling case that that anyone is negligent. Denial of service attacks against the top-level DNSs, the root DNS servers. This one doesn't worry me for a few reasons. One, for the most part, they seem to be run by really clueful people who take these sorts of things seriously and have lots and lots and lots of bandwidth to their, you know, at their aims. I mean, you know, some of these DNS servers have 2 gigabits of network bandwidth. Flooding that is hard. I mean, that's a lot of traffic. And you know, that means breaking into lots and lots and lots of machines in order to get 2 gigabits worth of bandwidth to break, or a few machines with really high network connection, fast network connections. But I think that's pretty hard. Also, they're extremely heterogeneous, so that heterogeneous, yeah, you know what I mean. So that, you know, one of them's running on Windows, another one's running on an AIX server, and, you know, they're so diverse in their setups and their configurations that it's pretty tricky to, you know, be able to take them all out at once, except via denial of service attack. And they've been pretty good at surviving in the past. So now I've talked about some of those, you know, scary things that the media seems to like bantering around these days about things that are scary. So I'm going to talk about some of the things that actually scare me now. I wonder if this got cut off. BGP abuse is one of the big things that I'm worried about these days. For those people not familiar with BGP, it's the Border Gateway Protocol. And it's basically the method that large ISPs use to handle routing between themselves, or ISPs in general. There's lots and lots of potential damage with BGP. The fact of the matter is if you're really smart at how you abuse BGP, you can do things like make ISPs drop off the network. And yeah, you know, they can get themselves back on the network, but they're going to be off the network for a while. And when I say ISPs, I mean ISPs and their customers, which means everyone. And you probably could even play games where you can start, you know, rerouting traffic so that it comes all through your machine first and then back out, though, you know, I don't know in practice how easy that is to do. So the damage is really high. This is one of these things that I think are going to be common between a lot of these things, high damage, low difficulty. BGP is inherently an insecure protocol. It's not just some implementation problem that can be easily fixed. The whole thing needs to be wiped out and replaced. And on top of that, all of the good ways that people have to, oh, this is how we can replace BGP, involve things like, you know, sitting there and, you know, implementing a global PKI infrastructure. Okay, well, most companies of more than a few thousand people have not been able to figure out how to implement a PKI infrastructure for their company. Why do we think we can get a global one to solve something like this? PKI is hard. So the other thing is that BGP inherently, each individual network trusts its peer networks to give them information about routing and those sorts of things. The way that peers are authenticated are by a plain text password over the network, if you're lucky. Most times, they're not authenticated except by, you know, IP address, and IP address is spoofable. You can MD5 hash the BGP password, but if you do that, you're still sending the MD5 hash over the network, so it's still replayable. But there's some advantage in doing this, actually, because with the passwords, your main concern would be that it would be stolen out of a... Well, they'd be sniffed over the network. But the fact of the matter is it's generally pretty hard to sniff the network between two large ISPs. You know, you have to go tap the fiber or something like that. Or you can break into one of the endpoints. But if you've broken into one of the endpoints, you have access to one of their routers, and you wouldn't really need to play around with BGP in the first place. But so the other way you could do it is you could pull it out of a configuration file stored somewhere. You know, Cisco stores all of their configuration files as text files. So that's why MD5 hashes are actually kind of useful. And then another thing about this that's concerning. So, okay, we've got lots of potential damage, not much security in the system itself, and it's really hard to fix. So this is something why I think BGP abuse is kind of a scary concept to me, and something where I worry that people are going to start paying attention to it. One thing to do is I go through these things that scare me and keep me up at night, is start thinking about ways they could be combined. Because that's the nightmare scenarios. I mean, you know, imagine large worms which abuse BGP in some way. You know, I don't know how that would work out, but it's just a frightening thought. Some resources on it. Stuff on protecting, and the middle one, ispbook.com, is easy to remember. It's a new book is a bunch of books, one of which covers sort of the sorts of things people would want to do to protect ISPs and you know, do networking for an ISP. Layer 2 attacks. The URL that's up there, the cisco.com one, this is all attacking stuff at the MAC address layer rather than the IP layer. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the specifics because there was a talk at both, like, Black Hat last year, I think, and at the Cisco Networkers talking specifically about all of these attacks. These scare me as well. These require someone to have broken into your enterprise's network first, for the most part, I believe. Maybe not all of them, but some of them are simple, letting you sniff traffic. I'm not too concerned about traffic sniffing because it ought to be encrypted in the first place. But they also let you do things like switch which VLAN you're on. So, you know, if people are trusting that, you know, all of their routers are protected so that they only have access from a specific VLAN, you know, the management VLAN sort of thing, then, you know, this is a really, really good way that you can suddenly get on that VLAN even though you're not there, because you can do layer 2 attacks. You can do all sorts of really, really nasty DOS attacks. You know, things where you can, you know, screw with the spanning tree stuff and all that. The thing that's scary about these is not so much the attacks, because I think the attacks are all neat, interesting attacks, but the fact that there's not much else out there to help you defend against the attacks. And those things that do help you defend against the attacks really don't scale well to large enterprises. You get these things where it's like, okay, you take every network jack in the wall and you tell it what MAC address is supposed to be on that network jack. You hard code that into the switch. This does not scale to 20,000 computers. This does not scale to 10 computers, much less 20,000. So it's really hard to do that. So all sorts of things that fall into that category where it's just like, you can't do that really. Same sort of thing for detecting these attacks. I don't know very many good tools for detecting these attacks. There's things like ARPWatch, which can, you know, sit there and show you all of the MAC addresses that show up on your address, or MAC addresses that show up on your network, your network segment. But, you know, again, trying to do that on any large scale is really, really hard. So, again, concerning. I think that we're going to see more of these. You know, people who really have it in for organizations, instead of, you know, flooding, you know, you want to take out the RIAA, for example, instead of going and flooding their internet connectivity, break in, you know, start using, you know, some of these attacks to denial of service them. It'll take them a lot longer to figure that out than it takes their ISPs to figure out how to protect it. Not that I'm advocating people break into the RIAA or anyone. It just happens that they happen to be a popular target these days. So again, we're following the networking theme at first. So compromising routers and switches, I'm amazed that people don't do this. I mean, people do this, but I'm amazed that they don't do it a whole lot more. I think that the reason why people don't do it a lot more is because Cisco knowledge is relatively hard to come by, particularly if you're 18. You know, you can't go out and buy yourself a Catalyst, you know, 7500, you know, router. It just, you don't have that type of money. Most large organizations don't have that type of money. But you can do a lot of stuff on Cisco routers and Cisco switches. You know, you can reroute where traffic is going. You can sniff the traffic. You can tunnel it off to other places, intercept it, play around with it, and feed it back in. I have this bypass firewalls thing, and this is a trick that we do on our network because it makes our lives a lot easier when we have firewalls for little things. What we'll do is we'll take a VLAN and we'll make that, you know, we'll basically have the firewall plug both into the network. We'll plug into the same switch on both sides, and one side goes out, is on a VLAN that goes out to the rest of the world, another side's on the protected VLAN behind it. Well, if you break into that switch, you can change what VLAN things are on. You can play all sorts of games there where you just sort of, whoops, swap it over, and you're right past the firewall. Don't need to worry about any of those rules. You just pull it out of the loop. You know, so that's a disturbing option if people get into the switch. Again, routers, you know, you route traffic, you know, play with those. I don't see very many people doing this. And again, you know, you also start looking at routers and you'll notice things like lots of routers still don't support really things that the security people consider very basic, like SSH. I mean, lots of people are telnetting to their routers to configure them. And, I mean, this is standard. In fact, lots of Cisco switches do not have enough memory to be able to run SSH on them. You know, to me, I sit here and I think, well, that's stupid of Cisco. You know, Cisco ought to, you know, spend a little bit more money and put in the extra memory in those hardware just to be able to use SSH. It's that important. But they don't think so. Of course, I don't need to worry about how much money they make and stockholders and all of that. So it's easy for me to say this. But and there's also this thought that if you can't actually trust your network, what can you trust on your you know, what is there out there that you can trust? Because everything sort of, you know, all of your information is passing over the network. Unless you're encrypting and authenticating it all and everything like that, you know, you just can't trust it. So people breaking into network devices is a scary concept. Also, I'll say that my experience is most networking people don't give much more than a little bit of lip service to security. This is changing slowly, but the fact of the matter is they don't. And again, networking devices don't care much about security either. So you get the combination of the two. You don't get any market pressure on Cisco to add SSH because none of the networking people think that it ought to be there. And it all ends up being kind of bad for security, particularly given that everything we're doing is running over these devices. So this is a different set of things. I'm off the networking track. This is the P equals NP thing. You know, and I'm not going to go into all the math here. I'm sure there's people in the room who can explain it a lot better than I could. But the fact of the matter is there's this little unknown thing in computer science about whether or not a non-deterministic Turing machine can decide a problem in polynomial time if that is also decidable by a deterministic Turing machine in polynomial time. Okay, so that's all a whole bunch of math thing. What does that actually mean? Well, it means that, and yeah, no, I'm not going to translate that into English. What it basically means is there's a whole set of problems out there, and someone has made a proof that says if you find any one of these, if you can show that it can be solved quickly, and right now it takes a long time, but if you can solve one of them quickly, you can solve all of them quickly. So these are things like the traveling salesman problem. You know, a salesman is going sort of from city to city and, you know, trying to find the optimal route to go through all of them. So let's say someone finds out a really clever algorithm for solving that. Well, it turns out if they solve that, they can also factor primes really quickly, which means that everything that we have that's based on almost all of the cryptography algorithms that anyone uses fails. You know, it's really easy to break all crypto. This is a really, really, really scary concept. It's an unknown. No one knows whether or not P is equal to NP. Most people sort of assume it probably isn't. They assume that there are different problem sets, but they don't know. But imagine a world without crypto. Imagine what your network would be like if you had to take out all the crypto in it. How many of the protocols that stuff run over your network would be secure by any, you know, sensible definition of secure if there was no crypto involved? This is a low likely one, but the amount of damage it could do is pretty high. So, you know, I'd sit here, and every once in a while and I'll think, okay, well, so we're you know, trying to secure this something or another. Let's sit down and try to think about what we would need to do if we couldn't use crypto on it. And almost all the time I end up scratching my head and going, I don't know. But crypto is a really, really large part of the security industry, and it's a, you know, single point of failure for a lot of things. So, again, changing themes a little bit. Vendors of business systems. Those of you in this room who have had to do what I have to do and sit in rooms occasionally and talk with vendors who you're going to buy products from, it's a scary concept, particularly people who handle really important stuff like your financial systems. You know, you get a W-2 every year for your taxes. How does that get through your system? It has all sorts of sensitive data on it. Same thing with, you know, time cards, paychecks, HR systems for tracking job applicants, for finding out who has what benefits, all sorts of financial systems involved with who buys what and, you know, where it gets billed to and so forth. I rarely sit in a meeting with one of these vendors and come out thinking, oh, they actually know what they're talking about when it comes to security. 9 times out of 10, I sit there and it's just like, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, generally they will say, oh, we've got a firewall. We don't need to worry about security. It's like, hello? Do you know anything about what's been happening in the security industry in the last, oh, say, 5, 10, 15 years? Firewalls do not cut it. They certainly do not cut it on their own, particularly when you're doing all this stuff via a web page. You know, my code audit, what's that? You know, we have this set of questions that whenever vendors come along, we ask them. And one of them is, have you had a code audit done? And the fact of the matter is it makes me a lot more comfortable, particularly when people are doing web page stuff, to know that someone's looked at their code, because I don't have time to look at all of their code. You know, the people in my group don't have time. No, we're trying to buy something so that we don't need to invest a lot of time into it. So it always ends up that, you know, you know these vendors come along and you buy it, and we've actually had vendors lie to us and say, oh yes, we handle X, Y, and Z, and then we get the product in-house and it turns out they don't handle X, Y, and Z at all. You know, so then it's like, okay, we need to make sure this gets in the contract, and you have to play other games like that. They're really, I want to be doing things like setting up firewalls, VPNs, you know, watching people break into machines, trying to stop them, and here I am spending lots of time like, okay, we've got to make sure that we've got the contract set right so that if the vendors are lying to us when they should be doing things securely in the first place, the fact of the matter is you can't trust that any of them are doing things securely in the first place. And what's really disturbing about this is these are the people who are handling the majority of your money in your business, and they don't know how to do security. This is scary. This keeps me up at night. So similarly related is application service providers. Think the same exact thing, except now, instead of the vendor sitting on your network, they're sitting on their own network. And what this means, and you know, generally it ends up being, you know, if you're using this for things with sensitive information of any sort, you know, all of your sensitive information is flowing right off of your network to some other network, generally via some algorithm you don't really know the details of. Oh yes, we encrypt it. You know, who knows how they encrypt it? They can't tell you. They don't have anyone on their staff who knows how they encrypt it, which is another frightening concept. You know, and they're but okay, so let's imagine that even if they are doing things reasonably well, you know, it's off your network. You have no way of knowing if anyone's broken into that machine. You have no intrusion detection there. They're certainly not going to let you put intrusion detection there. They probably won't even tell you what their network topology looks like. So, you know, you have to think, you know, when you're, you know, talking to an application service provider, will they let you know if their machine gets broken into? Again, good thing if you end up having to get in the contract writing things, make sure they're going to by contract. But, you know, this is a scary concept because you have no control over it. You have no way of knowing what happened when it happens. And, you know, the first time that you may know that someone, you know, has one of these machines has been broken into, even if you've got on your network all the intrusion detection in the world, is when you suddenly notice that a whole bunch of your employees are having their, you know, social security numbers stolen for identity theft, you know, and you just don't know. So ASPs scare me. Yeah, particularly ones with websites because, you know, my experience on this one is they don't filter input in the least. You know, we go through and a lot of these things and it's just like, oh no, filtering input, who needs to do that? Okay, so sensitive data is just another general category. And this is, you know, again, continuing on this more policy sort of thing. There's lots of legal liability. So I'm not worried about people suing me because my machine's broken into. I am worried about people suing me because all of my sensitive data got stolen. That strikes me as a lot more likely. And as far as I can tell, no one has a good policy on how to handle machines with sensitive data. I mean, except for the government. The government actually does. And, you know, when I look at this, I think, oh, let's steal stuff from the government. But, you know, you look at all, you know, a really good, you know, checklist of what should be in machines that, you know, to keep them secure and so forth. They don't have it. Most people don't even know what machines on their network actually have a sensitive machine on it. And then this whole leads into the privacy thing. So you're not only talking about, you know, sensitive data, but you're also talking about privacy policies and all of that. And privacy also scares me because I don't think anyone cares about privacy, which is disturbing. Consultants, again, you know, so okay, so a summary, bad guys, everyone who doesn't work for my organization. But my experience is consultants do really, really stupid things. I mean, we've had three different sets of consultants who have, you know, like a sysadmin has been sitting down at a machine and, you know, gotten up to go get a cup of coffee or something and found that the vendor has sat down at the machine and started typing on the keyboard. In two of those cases, they were adding themselves privileges to the system. In one case, they actually managed to take down a production system because they ran a stupid command that they had been told not to run, but they thought it was the right thing to do. I mean, the fact of the matter is consultants are not there to help you. They're there to get paid as quickly as they can and get out. You know, they don't want the job done well. They generally work in contention with the system administrators rather than with them. They don't care about the quality of it because, you know what, if they come up with some solution that's really, really brilliant but not at all supportable, it doesn't matter to them. They're not being hired to support it. They're being hired to implement it, and then, you know, it'll transition over to your organization for the supporting. So, you know, woe be to anything which slows down a consultant. So, you know, security, of course, which is one of the main things it tends to do, is slow people down and often, you know, make people actually think about what they're doing. You know, my experience is, you know, consultants, you know, don't care about security. So now I've talked about like vendors, consultants, ASPs, and these sorts of things. And the thing that I want to point out is I'm not talking about security people. You know, there are a lot of security vendors. I see, you know, people will write, you know, posts to BugTrack talking about little itty bitty, you know, obscure vulnerabilities that might possibly be exploited in, you know, some piece of security code that some company came up with. You know, yeah, okay, like gobbles, you know, that's the sort of thing. You know, if he were here, he'd probably be talking about that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is if they were to start looking at the financial systems that, you know, if they're trying to think about doing damage to people, if they're looking at the financial systems, I bet you they could find in 15 minutes at least 10 major things. No one cares about this in the underground community because there's no prestige in saying, you know, here's this little vendor who happens to be used by, you know, 95% of the Fortune 500 companies to handle their, you know, W-2 forms. I'm making up these numbers. I don't know if there's one vendor that does that. But looking, I mean, when we look at, you know, systems like this, it always ends up that there's only like three people out there in the first place. It's not like you have, you know, thousands of vendors to choose from. I mean, you know, you think, okay, how many intrusion detection systems are there out there? Maybe four or five. That's good. So you get a lot of options there in the intrusion when you're looking for an intrusion detection system. If you're looking for something to, you know, digitize, you know, your you know, paychecks and send them on to your, you know, mainframe for XYZ, there's maybe three people who make software that do this. They're not big name companies. Well, sometimes they'll be, you know, small segments of, you know, IBM or of, you know, someone else. But for the most part, they're not large companies, and no one targets them. And I really worry that someone's going to wake up one day and they're going to target them. And you know what? If you find a security vulnerability in OpenBSD, you know, I'm using OpenBSD for this slide, you know, so, you know, I like it. It's a nice thing. If you find it, what'll happen? You post it. There will be a fix within hours. You know, it's hours after you post it. You know, most of these people, most of these consultants, most of these ASPs, most of these vendors, they don't have anyone on their staff who knows anything about security. They don't need a security person. You know, so they think, and they think, okay, you know, if we write on a piece of paper, you know, and ask them when we're thinking about buying their software, if we ask them, how frequently do you do, you know, upgrades to your product? You know, how long does it take you to apply patches? They think that we want them to say, oh, we only apply patches a month or two after they come out, after we've gone through a full, you know, testing phase to make sure it's not going to crack down, you know, not going to break the system in any way. That's what they think is the good answer. To me, the good answer is if it's a security patch, we apply it within, you know, an hour of when it's released. That's a good answer. You know, that's one that makes me feel more comfortable. You know, but the fact of the matter is that's not, you know, they come from this very bureaucratic administrative point of view. So the fact is, okay, so now we've got these vendors and so forth where if you were to find a security vulnerability, which I think is probably really easy, though you have to get your hands on the software in the first place, which is really expensive. But, you know, most people can find the software if they look hard enough, particularly if you can break into the machines that are running them via some other method and just snag a copy of it. I mean, this is not hard. But so you've got these vendors who are, you know, selling, you know, really important pieces of software where they don't know anything about security. They don't have anyone on staff who knows anything about security. You know, so the fact, and they think that good turnaround time on a patch is on the order of a month or two. So the fact is if people started finding vulnerabilities in these vendors' pieces of software, we'd be in for a bit of trouble. So this is just another, this is one of my pet peeves. Security systems based on trust. Trust is a hard, hard, hard concept. How much do I trust someone? I don't know how to say how much I trust someone. It depends. What am I trusting them for? You know, how much do I trust? Do I trust Microsoft? This is my question. Well, maybe. I mean, I don't trust them to write a good operating system because I don't like their operating system. It's a, you know, I have critical security patches every week, two or three that patches, plural. I'm not trying to imply that they're as good as one a week. But, you know, and how are those applied to my system? Well, they automatically download, and there's some certificate that says, oh, yes, you know, this was signed by an employee at Microsoft, so therefore it must be secure. Well, okay, that doesn't mean that it is, because someone could easily have broken into that developer's workstation and captured the passphrase that they type in. Two, we know they're signed by VeriSign. We know that VeriSign has handed out Microsoft certificates in the past, so why do I trust them? You know, I mean, how do you decide if you're going to trust someone? And then realize, even if I can make it an informed decision that I trust or don't trust Microsoft in this case in order to apply this patch, the fact of the matter is every single end user is just going, oh, yeah, I trust them. You know, to end users, if someone is asked, do you trust someone or not, you know, and they will take it as, if I trust them, it'll work. If I don't trust them, it won't work. So I will trust them. You know, so any security system which is based primarily on trust is just really, really frightening to me. And I see more of these coming out rather than less. I see more effort going into how do we set up a trust infrastructure so people can make more informed decisions about trust, which is to say they can click yes no matter what. I see more effort going into this than going into issues like, you know, how do we, you know, make sure that no one breaks into, you know, Windows Update in the first place. I mean, the fact of the matter is Windows Update had NIMDA on it. You know, I mean, Microsoft is sitting here saying everyone should have patched their system. NIMDA was out, you know, the vulnerability was out 6 months before before NIMDA started spreading. But they didn't do it themselves. Why? Because patching systems is hard, and I'd really like to see a lot of effort into patching systems. And yeah, Microsoft's doing some of that now. But the fact of the matter is that every effort that goes into ignoring things like how you patch systems and instead goes towards, you know, trust is misplaced time, in my opinion, because trust is hard. Large-scale worms keep me up at night. Why? Because when they happen to hit our network, I get paged, and they happen to hit our network at like 2 a.m. So I lose sleep over them. There's lots of papers about how large-scale worms can get worse than they are currently. I expect that they will get worse than they are currently. But I'm pretty used to what we have now. I mean, the fact of the matter is the last 4 or 5 worms, I mean, Slammer was nastier and it spread faster and had side effects of doing DOS things. But I'm pretty used to this. I know the mechanism. Okay, a worm hits our network. I know the steps to go through in order to try to figure out which machines are, you know, compromised and infected and get them off our network until they can get fixed. But they can be pretty bad. Okay, so this is my summary slide. Before I talk about my summary slide, I'm gonna talk about one vulnerability because it's the vulnerability which has actually scared me the most in the last, well, in a long, long, long time. A while back, there was this vulnerability with SNMP, and the SNMP vulnerability scared the hell out of me. It scared the hell out of me because almost every device out there was vulnerable to it. I mean, like Solaris was vulnerable, Windows was vulnerable, every single networking equipment and printers and everything was vulnerable. Because why? Because someone way back in the old days at, you know, UC San Diego or wherever the hell it is that, no, it's not, I don't remember where. Is it UC San Diego? Wherever the original, which is it? UC Davis, right. So UC Davis is where the SNMP code came. Someone made a bunch of mistakes, and it's a bunch. It ended up being that it was like a suite of like 60 or 80 mistakes or something like that. But they had made a bunch of mistakes a long, long time ago, right? Everyone had been borrowing other people's code rather than rewriting it. So they all had these mistakes in them. And each one had slightly different mistakes. But the fact of the matter is you've got the point now where you could actually run code on pretty much every network device out there, every device that sits on the network, if you were clever enough. And clever enough in this case is probably pretty hard, thankfully. But here's where the interesting thing about this comes. So we sat down when we found out about this vulnerability, and the first thing we did is we said, what's the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario for us was one which required us to manually go around to every single one of our networking devices and reboot them. Now, this is assuming that whatever the attack was, this was assuming that step one, so we're going to assume there's some ongoing attack which did this, where we'd have to go around to all of our devices and reboot them. Well, we go around to all of our devices, we reboot it, it comes back up, and it dies again immediately because the bad traffic's going still on. So we've already had to disconnect ourselves from the internet, turn off our modem pool, turn off all of our other back doors into our network that we have everywhere. So say we've done all that. Then it's going to take us 2 weeks to go hit every single networking device. Our campus is about 6-8 blocks, in radius or so, and we have, something like 2,000-4,000 networking devices out there. This would take a lot of time to go reboot them. Then we're going to have to get some sort of version of code on this that has the problem fixed. How we're going to do that without having a network access is difficult. So this is a really scary scenario. Now, the most interesting thing about this to me is if you were to want to do lots of damage with this SNMP bug, the problem is not writing the exploit. The problem is trying to figure out how to get the furthest away device first and work your way back to the closest device to you. Okay, so because if you hit someone in the middle, you hit someone closer to you, then your networking then you can't get to everyone behind it, and all they have to do is fix that one device. So now that's hard. Now, if you also think about this, you're the bad guy doing this, and this is front page news because if you can do this to everyone on the internet, you can people will want your head for ages because the cost would be millions and millions of dollars. So you're in a situation where you've got to try to plot out the entire internet from your location. But of course you can't use your location, because if you use your location, then they can track it right back to you because they could reverse engineer all of that. So you have to sort of break into a couple of machines and bounce through some places first, which is all pretty standard stuff. But then you need to be able to map it from there, and you don't want any really slow links because mapping is going to be hard. So there's all sorts of reasons why this is a hard attack to do. But if you could do it, the damage would be devastating. The internet would be broken. That's why on the internet is broken slide I said, well, maybe there's a chance. But even if you weren't to do something that complex of mapping the internet, you were to do something a lot simpler, it would still do lots and lots and lots of damage. So there's lots of ways in which combine these into worms. Use some BGP attacks in there. So once you've go through your first phase, take out as many devices as you can, except for core routers that go between ISPs. Imagine you found some way to figure that out. Then screw with all the BGP tables. Then go and if you're a genius and have proved that P is equal to NP, and you can also bypass anything that involves cryptography and do all sorts of damage. Unlikely at this point. But the fact of the matter is that bits and pieces of this are actually fairly likely, in my opinion. People are going to start looking into these problems more because no one's looking into securing and preventing these problems, or those who are, even if they are doing it, it's a really hard problem to stop. So anyway, in general, what things scare me? Things that have a really widespread effect, either the internet in general or within my organization. Things like vendor systems that handle all of the paychecks. I like getting a paycheck, so if someone screws with that and makes my paycheck really small, I get upset. So things that require me to trust other people. I'm paranoid, so I don't like trusting people, and particularly people who don't work for my organization. Because if they work for my organization and they screw around, they can get fired. It doesn't mean so much to someone if they lose their contract with some company which they've just been hired to do something. Firing a consultant is not like firing someone who works for you. Things that make a large part of the infrastructure I have for securing things useless, those scare me. And the last one I think is the coup de grace or whatnot. Things that are poorly designed from the start. Particularly if the poor design propagates. But things are poorly designed from the start, of which I suspect a lot of people could argue is pretty much everything. But yeah, so any questions, comments? Other people have things that scare them that they want to talk about?
How do you distinguish the BGP problems that you're talking about with other problems that would knock out parts of the internet for hours?
Okay.
There have been BGP problems in the past.
Yeah. So the question is how you just... there are BGP problems, and in fact, with some regularity, people make mistakes that cause routing issues. So how do you distinguish those from an actual attack doing it? I don't know any good ways. I don't, there's some people out there who monitor BGP tables and try to get a good sense of how they all work out and so forth, and try to find things that look sort of suspicious. If the cert drops off of the internet because of a BGP problem, yeah, it may well be an attack, whereas, it may be a mistake if it's, someone else. So I don't know that there's a good way to distinguish, and I think that's part of why these things scare me, is because human error and intentional errors seem very similar a lot of times. And, I guess it'd be interesting to start plotting the number of significant BGP incidents that happen. By incident, I don't mean security incident. I mean where something weird happens with the BGP things and someone blanked off the network for a while. If you get a plot of these and see if, suddenly there's a spike, that might tell you that it's intentional. But, yeah, I don't know. Other questions, comments, fears? Well, thank you very much. Oh, wait, in the back. Okay, so the question is there something beyond the authentication issues that make BGP insecure? I'm by no means a BGP expert. The thing which worries me the most is the authentication aspect. I don't know of other large problems with it, but anything else? Well, thank you.